You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcasts and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Thank you for joining another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the talk of wrestling. I'm Brian Ferguson. We have a returning guest today, historian, knows a lot about other territories other than the AWA. I want to welcome back Mr. George Shire. George, thanks for coming back on the show today.
Well, thank you, sir. You're one of the few people that call me Mister. I always said my dad was Mister. I'm just George.
Well, you know, we got to respect each other.
I understand. Thank you. No, it's fun to be back. I always enjoy doing this with you, Brian.
Yes, I enjoy talking with you, too. And we were talking before we came on, all the positive feedback we've been getting from around the world about our discussions and your knowledge, and it's been great. And I always enjoy having you on as well, and I appreciate you being back on with us today. So looking forward to our discussion today, which is about the St. Louis territory. That's why I'm wearing the NWA shirt, because it was part of the NWA for many years.
So, it was the NWA, to be honest.
Yeah. So first I want to get into kind of the background of the St. Louis promotion. Can you tell us a little bit how it all kind of came together? And
well, please realize that if we were to go into the complete long history of everything that happened, because this was a city that was being promoted way back in the 1920s. You know, so we're talking 100 and some years ago. So if we were to go way back and start doing that, even that's a little bit over my head as far as, I guess even where I really want to go, because we'd have to have about a 20-hour show. But here's the bottom line. When wrestling was in its boom, or started to boom, in the 30s, a little bit before World War II. And with that, I want to make a comment about World War II. Okay. We had a ton of wrestlers around the country in the 20s and 30s. Now, we're talking 100 years ago. We had a ton of wrestlers that by the time World War II had come around, most of these guys were getting up into their 30s or 40s. Some of them 50s, and the younger guys, they were hauled off to World War II, sent off to World War II, And when the war ended 4 years later, there was a whole new breed of young wrestlers in the later 40s that were there to kind of replace that old guard that had either, some of them had passed away, some are obviously older, and some of them just couldn't wrestle anymore. So there was a lot of younger breeds. So for me, the St. Louis territory, like most other territories around the country, really started to flourish and take hold and attract fans in the later 40s.
Yeah. Well, I did a little background search, and I thought St. Louis was primarily – it was primarily run by Sam Muchnick. But I realized there was somebody before him that was kind of his mentor from what I've read.
Yeah.
By the name of his name was Tom Pax. Can you give us a little background on Tom?
Well, Tom Pax was the original St. Louis promoter, and there was a company, or the organization at the time was called the National Wrestling Association.
Okay.
You mentioned Tom Pax, so I just happened to think, well, if you mention his name, I am going to I've got it written down here. If I can find it real quick.
Okay.
Well, it isn't even really important. His real name was not Tom Pax. It's a long name from Greece where it was shortened. We don't need to really go into that.
Okay.
And they settled on Tom Pax because, you know, it sounds better. And the same is true for Sam Muchnick, by the way. His real name was, I believe it was Jesus or
Jesus.
How do you say that?
Jesus.
Yeah. See, I always get mixed up with those.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think his real name was Jesus.
Oh, wow.
And they just realized that, you know, instead of introducing somebody that way, we'll call him Sam. So Sam Muchnick. You said Muchnick.
I'm sorry.
The general. No. That's why we're here. We learned this. The general pronunciation was Muchnick.
Muchnick. Okay.
Just more the way it looks. So
yeah.
Sam. He worked, he was a newspaper reporter.
Okay.
And he loved baseball, Sam Muchnick. Yeah. And he was a reporter in St. Louis. And he started working around Tom Pax, kind of working in a position where he'd be, you know, helping out the promoter and different things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as he's doing this, he's learning. And he eventually lost his position at the newspaper he was at. But Sam, during this time, was a very, very respected and loved individual. He was a guy that was always considered fair. The people that he worked around and worked with in the sporting world, they enjoyed him, they trusted him, they loved him. So doing this, working in Tom Pack's office, Sam and Tom eventually had some differences between them in, as far as philosophy and that sort of thing. And Sam decided, you know, he was going to try and promote wrestling opposition to him.
Oh.
Well, in doing this, this was one of the old school promotional wars. You know, one of the things that modern day fans or the fans of the last 30 years think that the only time that territories were ever invaded by another promotion was when Vince McMahon started his expansion to go national in 84. But throughout history, there have always been little promotional wars. For the most part, every territory minded its own boundaries. I mean, it's like they had an invisible fence around their territory, and another promoter would not come in and promote a card within that fence. And, of course, those promoters wouldn't go to another territory either. So generally, it was a gentleman's agreement, and they minded their own business. But there always were, throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s, even into the 70s, every once in a while, there'd be a pop-up promotion that would try to run against the established group.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that when it happened was, in most cases, the promoter that was trying to come into a territory, he would rally around and gather up all his friends in the business, meaning fellow wrestlers or promoters, et cetera, and kind of get them to, hey, come on board with me. We're going to do this. We're going to run this guy out of town or whatever it's going to be. And they generally were short-lived.
Yeah.
In most cases, the established promoter for promotion eventually won out.
Yeah.
And for various reasons. But when those rival promoters would come in, they would always bring in a lot of talent. I mean, the cards, when you look at them, they were loaded because the promotion or the promoter that's trying to come into the territory is calling on favors from his friends, his fellow wrestlers, and bringing them in, putting together these outstanding cards. And that also forced the established promotion then to also put on these, I guess in the era you'd have called them spectaculars, because yeah. they would have tons of talent. And for the short term, when these wars were going on, really the fans were the winners.
Yeah.
But at the end of them, in most instances, it was the established promotion that eventually won out. And then things would go back to normal in a yeah. particular city or territory.
Yeah.
So in St. Louis, with Tom Pax, when he was promoting and Sam Muchnick started sort of running opposition, eventually Sam Muchnick won out,
yeah.
called upon enough people and had enough clout and respect that he won out over the promotion. Now that's a capsule look at how that took place.
Yeah.
And eventually Tom Pax was no longer promoting. That's the short story of one that we could, and literally, I mean, we could talk for yeah. a couple hours on St. Louis. It, as I said, it goes back 100 years.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so talking about Sam, you know, what do you think it was about him that St. Louis was just a hotbed for so many years that he – What was that it factor for St. Louis, that in your opinion?
Well, it's my opinion, but it's also, I think we could bear it out as fact.
Okay.
Again, it goes back to Sam Muchnick being a very respected journalist, newspaper man. You know, people today, I mean, if you talk to someone today, they barely know what a newspaper is anymore because, you know, that part of our culture is leaving us. But yeah. if you go back, you know, to the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, et cetera, the newspaper was our main source of getting news.
Yeah.
Other than if you turned on the nightly news on a television set.
Right.
And so newspapers were very respected. And generally speaking, the reporters, they earned a trust amongst their listeners or amongst their readers. And Sam Muchnick just was highly, highly regarded. I told you he loved baseball. That was one of his fortes. So he's very respected as a baseball reporter, and he had those ins. And once you get in those little circles, you know, you have people that, hey, you need to talk to Sam Muchnick, or you, yes, talk to Sam. He's the guy.
Yeah.
And that's where it all came from. He was highly regarded and respected. Most everybody yeah. that I have ever talked to about Sam Muchnick, and when I say most everybody, I'll share that back about, this would have been about 2001. I sat down and I talked with Lou Thez mm-hmm. for a little bit of time about okay. different things. And one of the things that he said more than once while we were talking was that he had his differences with Sam Muchnick. You know, when you're in a business like pro wrestling, you always have to remember there are egos butting heads yeah. all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't have an ego in wrestling, then you can't go into wrestling. But I think yeah. I think that's pretty true for any sport or entertainment venue. You yeah. got to have a pretty good ego.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, Sam and I, we had our differences. But he said, I always respected him, and he always was fair with me,
yeah.
and he took care of me, and he paid me well. And so if you come away with that type of a compliment from a wrestler regarding a promoter,
yeah,
I think that speaks pretty highly. And when you make it Lou Thez that's telling you this,
mm-hmm.
Anybody that knows anything about old school wrestling, few are more revered in this business than Lou Thez was.
Right.
So what made Sam credible was the fact that he was what you saw, Sam Muchnick. And he would go to bat for you. He would, if he was right, he was going to stand up for it, and he would always go to bat for his guys. And he had a loyalty among the wrestlers that they wanted to work with him. So as we have that Tom Pax thing kind of fading into the sunset,
yeah,
you know, there was always the controversy in wrestling about who is the world champion. If you go back to the 30s and the 40s, I guess you could go all through history, but it seems like there were always territories that were billing someone as the world champion.
Yeah.
I remember talking to one of my friends about the 1960s. He says, well, you know, wrestling, they got all these champions. Everybody's a world champion. Well, yeah, in a sense, that was true, but there were only a couple or three officially recognized world champions at that time. And so when you get to St. Louis, you have the National Wrestling Association that recognized various guys. Wild Bill Longson was one of them, and he was the real deal. Bill Longson was a tough old son of a gun that, you know, he was a guy you could call on to go in the ring, and if the guy doesn't cooperate with you in the ring, well, Bill Longson's going to make sure you're going to be in the hospital. In those days, that stuff was for real.
Yeah.
So, but as we get to the Sam Muchnick era in St. Louis, and he became the promoter, basically, that was making the money and giving to the fans, the idea came about that, you know, we have to have one world champion.
Yeah.
We have to come up with, you know, everybody's got a world champion, and the guy's like, he's a world champion, but he only wrestles in one town. Mm-hmm. And so guys like Sam Muchnick, there was a promoter named Al Haft out of Ohio. There was Tony Stecker from Minneapolis. Pinky George from Des Moines, Iowa. And there were a couple of others. And they all got together, put together a summit, so to speak, and started talking about we would organize this alliance, the National Wrestling Alliance. And in doing so, it was our goal, their goal, to have one world champion. And that is really what the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance, was. It was never a territory.
Yeah.
It was never anything more. A lot of people think, well, there were three territories in the 60s, you know, the AWA, NWA, and the WWWF.
Right.
But the NWA was just a champion. And what this conglomerate of promoters decided upon was, we will give the fans one world champion. We will agree on that champion, and we will have other promoters from other territories pay dues or pay an annual fee, so to speak. And in doing so, they will be part of our group, and they will get to have the champion come into their town, their city, or their little, you know, territory, whatever cities they were running. And they would have him one or two or three times a year, whatever the schedule would permit. So it was a very logical and thought out plan that back in that era made sense.
Yeah.
And each year they would have an annual meeting, these promoters. Tony Stecker in Minneapolis, along with Wally Carbo, they stayed members of this. And Wally Carbo, by the way, was in on that first meeting as well. So they all stayed together. They would vote each year on whether or not the guy that was their champion at the time, do we want to keep him on as champion, or do we want to put it on somebody else?
Yeah.
So when these groups of promoters, they got together, they decided they were going to have this one champion,
mm-hmm.
and they vote each year whether they're going to change the champion or not. To start this off, they said, well, we have to come up with one guy that will be our first champion. So originally, they were going to go with an elimination match between Lou Thesz and Orville Brown.
Okay.
Now, Orville, sadly, was involved in a car accident right before this match was to take place. And I don't know if they had planned on letting Orville win the match or not, but he was certainly at that time on par with Lou Thesz and probably two of their best wrestlers and workers. And he was involved in an accident which ended his wrestling career.
Yeah.
So they just put the title, the National Wrestling Alliance world title, on Lou Thesz. And with that, I'm going to correct something that is generally wrong.
Okay.
All through the 50s and 60s and 70s, Lou Thesz was always billed as being a six-time NWA world champion. Well, he officially only held the NWA Alliance champion three times.
Ah.
He was the association champion three times. Now, and that goes way back to the 1920s again. So what they did was, is they, if you look at any history site, they'll show you the lineage of the National Wrestling Alliance title. Mm-hmm. And through the years, they've just morphed the two together.
Okay.
And in essence, Lou became a six-time champion, which of the Alliance, technically, he wasn't. But considering everybody accepted that as being a fact that he was and that the two were merged together, I've never had a problem with it. It's just that I was going to bring that clear for you so that listeners.
I'm glad you did. I didn't know that. See, that's something interesting. I'm sure a lot of fans probably didn't know that either.
So Lou Thesz, he's our first NWA, and I'll always say Alliance champion going forward, okay?
Yeah, okay.
He's our first Alliance champion. Lou Thesz, real deal in wrestling. He was a hooker. Lou Thesz was the guy who garnered respect. He wanted you to respect him as a wrestler.
Yeah.
He took the business very seriously. He was a guy that when he was out on the street, and when he carried the championship of the NWA for, holy heck, up until 56, he was champion for like five-year run. And then he gave it up just for a short time. And when I say he gave it up, I'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Gave it up for just a short time, and he was champion again. So, but he was a guy that always dressed in a suit and tie when he was out in public and when he was representing the wrestling at any organization or any event, he was, you know, very presentable. He thought that was important.
Yeah.
And he was a guy that, as the generation of wrestling was changing already in the 50s with television really profiling wrestling, we had a lot of characters come on board. When I say characters, I'm talking guys that weren't really wrestlers.
Yeah.
But they were colorful personalities. And, you know, the main one that comes to mind is Gorgeous George.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But George was a great, I won't say he was a great wrestler. He was a good wrestler. But he was bland. He wasn't making any money. He wasn't really big.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
And he was wrestling on middle of the card, not making any money. And he was the innovator. He came up with the idea that, you know, hey, we got to give these people something different.
Yeah.
So he was the one, the very first one that, you know, went and got his hair permed Now, when you go back to the 40s, the late 40s, early 50s, and you think of a man getting a perm,
yeah,
I mean, that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
Happened in the 70s when, you know, all guys were getting perms in the 70s.
Yeah.
I think I did, too, when I had hair. But here's Gorgeous George, who then gets his hair bleached blonde, and it was always more white than blonde.
Yeah.
And he's got these longer curls and his blonde hair, and he comes up with the robe and the arrogance, the cockiness, appearing in those days to be somewhat feminine.
Yeah.
And that was a gimmick that got old. But that didn't sit well with Lou Thesz. He didn't like that gimmick wrestling. So usually Lou didn't like to be matched against those type of wrestlers.
Yeah.
And if he had been or was, he basically wasn't going to put him over.
Yeah.
And that was the way the business was run. So Lou had some clout.
Yeah.
But Lou drew well. And as champion, that's what Sam Muchnick went with and the other promoters of the Alliance for that first 5 or 6 years.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. There was a lot of guys that went through St. Louis. Harley Race, Ken Patera, Ric Flair, the who's who in the really the 60s, 70s, and even in the early 80s. But I've also been, when I read, and I want to clarify this with you, is that Sam and his St. Louis club, wrestling club, no tag team championship. Is that right?
That is officially right. The Alliance never, ever endorsed or had official National Wrestling Alliance World Tag Team Champions. Now, when you look at wrestling magazines and territory fan club bulletins and programs of the 50s and 60s and 70s,
mm-hmm.
you will find many territories that advertised having NWA World Tag Team Champions.
Right.
What that was, Brian, is a promoter in a territory. Let's just use Florida, for example.
Okay.
Florida had NWA Tag Team Champions, but that was just their version of the Tag Team Championship. They were never officially endorsed by Sam Muchnick and the so-called Alliance.
Okay.
But because that promoter or that territory was a member of the Alliance,
mm-hmm.
they were able to have their World Tag Team Champions. But the NWA never had one team.
Yeah.
And that's what's confusing. You know, if you want to do a history of the WWF title or the AWA Tag Team title, or many others too, but especially those two, it's very easy to do because you can trace it. But with the NWA world title, at the same time, in one time period, you could have three or four different teams in different parts of the country being billed as NWA champions.
Why?
And they just didn't have them.
Why do you think they did that? I mean, because tag team wrestling, was it not, I don't know, accepted part of the promotion as a full-time basis? I mean, they had their six-man and all that. But
tag team wrestling was extremely popular, and a lot of territories highlighted tag team wrestling over singles wrestling as far as main events and different things for a good part of their time in promoting.
Okay.
In St. Louis, again, you have Sam Muchnick, who is, for practical purposes, a purist. He always believed that the singles match was the one that was the main event on a card. And it had to be a contest between two guys, two wrestlers that the fans wanted to see. And when it was the world champion, which St. Louis was the headquarters, of course, he always had that NWA title match on top. He would never put a tag team over it as being the spotlight match to come to.
Yeah.
So he was very serious about that. And he and again, with Lou Thesz, he was a guy that never wanted to have any billing around. And because, you know, it's weird. Because Lou was respected and he always did what promoters asked, but he also could do what he wanted.
Yeah.
And they knew they could count on Lou.
Yeah.
He could get what he wanted.
Yeah.
And he did that. So Sam just wasn't going to have National Wrestling Alliance tag team champions. And because the, you know, here's another way to look at it. Because their singles champion, whoever it was at any particular time, was going around the country, you know, one night he'd be in Florida, one night he'd be in, the next night he's in Texas, then he might be in California, then he might be up in Calgary, Canada, well, then he might be down in Mexico. I mean, they did not have a tag team that could do that type of traveling. This also, let's just talk about this, this presented a problem as time went on for that NWA world champion. Because as we had 25 territories, there were times when it virtually became impossible for the whoever was the NWA champion at the time to endure the schedule that he was being put through on a yearly basis. And if you look at NWA title history, with but a few exceptions, and there are explanations for those exceptions that, again, we could go into and it'd be another half hour of a show. But generally speaking, the NWA champion, when they were crowned, it was with the idea that they would be champion for at least a year, usually 2 to 3. That was what the consensus was.
Yeah.
So when we get into towards the time when Buddy Rogers became champion.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go back just a step farther.
Sure.
In St. Louis, Dick Hutton took the title from Lou Thetz. Lou had went to Sam and said, I need some time off. I want to give up the belt for a while. We need to come up with somebody. However, I'm going to be able, I want to choose who I'm going to drop it to. And that was important for Lou again, because how he respected the business, how he saw the business should, the champion should be represented.
Yeah.
Well, he chose Dick Hutton. Dick Hutton was an extremely gifted wrestler. He was an amateur. He and Vern Gagne had hooked up in the Olympics.
Okay.
And Hutton was he again was another one. I always refer to him as that real deal. Amateur turned professional. And that was the guy, by all facts, that made a good choice when Lou said, I want to drop it to Dick Hutton. Well, the only problem was is that Dick Hutton was a logical choice, but he didn't draw.
Yeah.
His personality was not conducive to him drawing fans. He was a bland personality. He had the skills, but he couldn't get the people to come in. And that was the problem the NWA was having for the year or so that Dick held the title. And he'd go into a town, and the world champion's coming to town, and the promoters weren't drawing.
Yeah.
So, you know, when the champ came to town in those days, it only happened once or twice, maybe 3 times a year. That was a huge deal in a town.
Yeah.
When the world champion was coming, because he wasn't there every week.
Right.
He wasn't on TV every week. But Dick Hutton wasn't doing the job. So that was one of those short times where they said, okay, the Alliance got together when they're in their annual meeting, and they said, we got to come up with a guy that is going to take the title. Then Pat O'Connor came.
Okay.
And Pat O'Connor, again, another legit wrestler.
Yeah.
That's what the NWA always wanted.
Yeah.
Very, he was charismatic. He was very likable. He drew well. He had the title for a couple years, and he dropped it to Buddy Rogers, the Nature Boy.
The original Nature Boy.
The original Nature Boy.
That's right.
Now, that's when things started to get a little bit hairy, because there were some outside forces, and the Alliance didn't have the power over Rogers that they had over the other wrestlers. And again, this is something we could go into very deeply.
Yeah.
But Rogers was more controlled by the East Coast promoters.
Yeah.
And it became a difficult story. So a couple years into the Rogers run, even though Rodgers drew well, it was difficult to get him. And that was the whole idea of the champion for the NWA. He agreed to work specifically for us. He's right. At our disposal. We'll tell him where to go every night of the week.
Yeah.
So when that became difficult with Rodgers, they Sam Muchnick went back and pulled out Lou Thesz, asked Thesz, and Thesz at that point in time in 1963 was, for wrestler standards, was an older man. Because he'd been wrestling since the 20s. So Lou did it pretty much as a favor. And Lou didn't like Buddy Rogers. We could talk on a half-hour show about that. But Buddy didn't like Lou Thesz. So the idea was is that Buddy wasn't going to lose to Lou. Well, Lou Thesz just made it very simple. And this is fact, guys. Lou went to Buddy in the locker room, and he told him, he said, Buddy, it's simple. When we go out there tonight, we can do this the easy way, or we can do it the hard. But I'm walking out with the belt tonight. And Buddy had no choice. Buddy could not wrestle with Lou. And if Lou didn't want to lose, he wasn't going to lose. So it was determined that Lou was going to win by the alliance, and he took the title from Buddy. So Lou had it then for 3 years. Again, it was time for him. He was at the twilight of his career. He wanted to slow down. He gave it to Gene Kanisky. And that's how that went. So you got these three-year intervals. And if you follow it from Gene Kanisky on out, up until we get to Terry Funk in the 70s, if you look at it, it was generally about 2 to 3 years, with the exception of the Dory Funk Jr. to Harley Race match the very first time. And there's a story behind that. So anytime you're involved in wrestling, there's some backstage stuff that took place that, you know, you never really heard about because they didn't want you to know it.
And Sam was the president of the NWA for many years. And, you know, he was the president, and then he was the, you know, promoter for St. Louis. So he kind of, maybe I'm wrong, he kind of had an upper edge. Okay, I'm the president, so, you know, I can funnel. I know they funnel guys all over, but the Mecca was St. Louis. I mean,
well, St. Louis was Sam's home. And for the most part, Sam would get, you know, there's, you got to understand too, that because Sam was in reality controlling the champion, whoever it was, Sam got a percentage of the champion's fee as he went around the country. So Sam was getting, but that was all agreed on by the alliance promoters. And Sam was the person that was doing the scheduling and taking care of the business and providing all these other territories with the champion and the schedule. And, you know, the other thing I would say about that schedule, when we talk about that three-year, two-year term that the champion would run around the country, in most cases, Brian, it was the champion himself that would go to Sam, go to the alliance, and say, guys, I want the belt taken off. I got to give it up. I'm gone. I'm gone 367 days a year, and there's only 365 in the year. You know, I need to have some time off. And the travel. I mean, you think about it. It wasn't anything. And this is in the day when we didn't have a lot of air travel and jet travel, that sort of thing. But the travel was, you know, the guy just got to go to a match, defend his title, get on an airplane, go to the next city the next night, then get on an airplane, go to the next city. And that's what and he had a very lonely life. The NWA champion during any tenure that they had, they generally didn't have the camaraderie with any of the wrestlers in the locker rooms and the different towns they wrestled in, because they weren't one of the boys. They were the guy coming in just for tonight to defend the title, then he's gone. And most of the guys, I mean, they liked the championship, but they would tell you that for their personal lives and they're probably overall just health-wise, it wasn't a healthy thing. And yeah. You get to 2 or 3 years, and they're saying, okay, I want it taken off of me. Come up with somebody to take it off. And that's what would happen. They'd have these annual meetings, and again, they'd talk about, well, which, you know, and the promoters all had their ideas, too, in yeah. these meetings. You know, we'd like to have so-and-so have a title run, or I want my guy to have a title run, you know, this guy, that guy. But it always came down to a consensus, to a vote, and it was usually decided upon who was going to be the heir apparent to whoever was the current champion.
Yeah, I read some stuff. Tim Hornbaker.
Hornbaker is an awesome historian.
Yeah, he wrote a
very well respected.
Yeah, he wrote a book on the NWA.
Yep,
a couple of them actually.
The NWA book you're referring to is what I consider for the NWA to be the Bible, and yeah. Tim did an excellent job of researching it.
Yeah,
the untold story of the NWA.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. I finished it. I read it a few months back. Great, great read. If you're a wrestling fan, it's a great read. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's long, but it's good, in my opinion. I mean, and I'm not much of a reader, and I couldn't put it down.
Yeah. A lot of wrestling fans, this isn't a cut on wrestling fans, but a lot of wrestling fans don't like to read long dissertations and historical facts. I think many of them would prefer maybe to listen to them or have a story told. But going back and reading a book like Hornbaker, The Untold Story of the NWA or the National Wrestling Alliance, mm-hmm. It's not something you can sit down and read in a few minutes. It's something that you're going to take some time with, and you're going to have to go back and forth and look at it. But good book.
That is a very good book. Talks a lot about Sam and the NWA, how they all formed. It's a great read. I really enjoyed it. And so getting back to St. Louis, you know, we talked about the champions going through there, Sam. You know, Sam had a program at the Chase. Can you talk about the Chase a little bit and what that relationship with the NWA and that motel really is what it was?
Yeah, it was the Chase Hotel. I always get the name of the room, the banquet type room that they held the wrestling in. I'm not even going to attempt to say it. It starts with a K, and I read it and I can't pronounce it. And I was in the room a few times.
Yeah.
But in the Chase Hotel, Sam did this very differently, because this banquet room, they would actually have the banquet tables set up. The people that were there were having this elite dinner. They would come in, and the ladies in their evening gowns and the men in their suits and tuxes. It was very formal. They would sit around the tables like any big banquet room. Mm-hmm. But in one corner of the room, they would have the wrestling ring set up, and they would hold the TV wrestling, and it was done in front of an audience of high class people. This wasn't your normal in those days, not your normal wrestling fan, but this was something in St. Louis that caught on.
Yeah.
I wish I could pronounce the name of the room, but other St. Louis fans will know what I'm talking about. So they would tape wrestling at the Chase. And it was a studio setting, but different from any other studio setting, because when you looked at other TV productions of wrestling, you had the bleachers around two corners of the ring and three rows of fans sitting in them.
Yeah.
And, of course, the fans were there in their shorts and their tank tops and, you know, whatever. It was just they were wrestling fans.
Yeah.
But in this room at the Chase Hotel, it was class. And that also helped with a guy like Lou Thesz, because he was appearing before people that were upper echelon, so to speak. Very popular program. And I was there. I had the opportunity to be there twice for television tapings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very enjoyable.
Yeah, it was a program on St. Louis television for 24 years.
Live from the Chase.
Live from the Chase. And for a program to last that long, in that era even, says a lot, especially for wrestling. I mean, I'm not saying wrestling programs were bad, but I'm saying on the same channel for 24 years,
yeah,
it says a lot about the quality of the program.
Well, so. And St. Louis as a promotion, the city had not only the longevity with the TV station, which again is important because the fans always knew where they could turn to catch wrestling.
Yeah.
And with Sam at the helm, being the respected person he was, they had the Kiel Auditorium, yes, which was I got to tell you something. In the days when I was able to go around to some of these territories, I have really fond memories of the Kiel Auditorium. It was as classic an arena for wrestling presentation that you could find.
Okay.
It was you looked outside and it was an old brick building, a big square, rectangular, however it was, building in a city block. But inside it was like typical arenas or auditoriums were in that day, where you had the chairs, the bleachers around the stands around the ring in the middle of the arena.
Yeah.
And very, very fun place to visit. And the fans were always very cordial. I was at St. Louis Kiel Auditorium probably about a half a dozen times.
Yeah.
And I never thought I saw an unruly fan there.
Wow, that's pretty good to say.
I can tell you in some arenas I was in, even my hometown of the Twin Cities, there were times when there's a fight breaking out up in the bleachers.
Yeah.
You know, but St. Louis, I don't know. It just, it was a fun city for wrestling.
Yeah.
And Sam would put on the, I want to talk a little bit about Sam's promoting of the characters. Sam also believed, I told my wife today I was going to mention this.
All right.
Sam had the belief that the world champion was the elite of the business. And for that reason, on his St. Louis cards, you could never have a king or a lord or a baron.
Uh-oh.
So... He believed that, and this is a funny story, I shared this on one of our AWA shows. Baron von Raschke, when he became Baron von Raschke in 1967, everywhere he wrestled around the country, and Baron traveled.
Yeah.
He was all over as this, putting over this German gimmick of his. And everywhere he went, he was Baron von Raschke.
Yeah.
Well, when he went to St. Louis, Sam told him, I can't have a baron because a baron is royalty and that would appear that it's better than the champion. And he said, so you're von Raschke. And when I originally had Baron tell me this story back in 99, mm-hmm. Baron told the story and he goes, so I go into St. Louis and I'm demoted. He's not a baron. But if you look at any St. Louis program, von Raschke, and he was pushed. Sam used him a lot. He was he was over huge as a German heel in St. Louis, never as Baron. And he would not bill. If Jerry Lawler came in, he wasn't Jerry the King. He was Jerry Lawler. And the same would go. Lord Alfred Hayes, he had trouble too because didn't want to be billed as a lord. Sam didn't like that.
Yeah.
But, to his credit, you know, he had a standard and that's what he fed his fans and the fans accepted.
Well, it's amazing too that I think versus today's wrestlers, I think more the wrestlers respected, I shouldn't say respected, accepted what the promoter wanted. If it wasn't too, okay, you're not Baron Von Raschke because I consider the champion to be above everybody, so you're Von Raschke. I don't know nowadays if somebody is like, you know, we got all these kings on WWE example, you know, you got, and if they say, well, we're going to change it, I don't know if you're up to the, there, that would be acceptable, but different time, different era, different things.
Well, the business, I mean, you know, again, whenever we want to sit down and talk about then and now, that is a true apples to oranges analogy.
Yeah.
They're not the same. They're not even close to the same, but each has their own merits and their own fans and their own following. You know, a dinosaur like me, I'm not interested in the current product, but the current product, you know, they look at the old product and they go, those guys, you know, they don't know this for fact because they weren't there.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they were old, they were slow, they didn't do this, they didn't do that. And it's just the way it is.
Yeah. No, I must be a dinosaur too because I mean, I watch some of it just kind of keep up a little bit, but I don't watch it like I did as a kid. I don't watch it.
Yeah.
My wife thinks I watch it a lot, but I don't watch it nearly as much as I used to.
Well, I don't watch it at all. In fact, I just had Mick telling me yesterday that I should give AEW a try. And I have given AEW a try a couple of times previous, not recently.
Yeah.
But I can get to about, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes of it if I last that long. And I'm thinking, okay, I just need these 5 minutes back in my life. I'm never going to get them. I'm not going to waste an hour on it. So,
yeah.
But it doesn't mean it's bad, Brian. It's not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
Let's talk about St. Louis as a promotion and how Sam worked it as far as bringing guys in.
You must have been reading my mind because that's what I was going to talk to you about next. Go ahead.
Well, I'm clairvoyant too. The St. Louis, because it wasn't a territory. It was a city that Sam promoted. Sam didn't promote any other city, any other town. His only other obligation, other than promoting matches, running cards in St. Louis, usually on a monthly basis. And I will point out that he usually ran from August through June. They took the summer off. There was always about 4 or 5, 6 weeks in between, or six, seven, 8 weeks before the next card in August.
But
he did not have the resources that a lot of territories did, where they had a lot of wrestlers that were, for lack of a better word, and a handshake under contract with them to work the territory for a specified amount of time. Sam only had St. Louis, and so he would always call upon his resources and his fellow wrestlers that he could count on, and he would bring them in. And so when you look at, just take the 50s going into the 60s, it was a, The St. Louis cards, the lineups are always fun to look at because no two cards in a row ever have all of the same wrestlers on them. They might have a couple of the same main eventers, but the undercards are always interesting because he would bring in a couple of wrestlers from the Central States region, you know, Kansas City and Iowa, et cetera. He would bring in maybe a couple guys from Texas, or bring in someone, two guys from Florida, someone from California. Even some of the guys from out east, he'd bring them in for a card. And we had very interesting matchups. And so the cards were always fun to look at. And the guys would come in and they didn't have to do anything more than come in and get a payday from Sam. He brought in AWA guys. When we got into the later 60s, into the 70s, AWA guys would go into St. Louis. Lanza, Duncan, Bockwinkle, Vern Gagne, Greg Gagne, Jim Brunzel. There were other AWA wrestlers that would go in for that one night. They ran, St. Louis ran Saturday nights. Friday nights was always Houston. Saturday nights, I'm pretty sure. And the guys could go into town, get paid, and go home.
Yeah.
But there was a loyalty to Sam. If Sam called up a wrestler and said, hey, you know, you want to come in? I got a date open. I'll be there, Sam.
Yeah.
And that says something in itself. So his card rosters are very – I love looking at them.
Yeah.
Because you see a lot – and you see a lot of different matchups too. Mm. Now, Sam also had another quirk, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
He wasn't, you know, because he wasn't heavy into the gimmicks in St. Louis, mm-hmm. the gimmick wrestler per se, he wasn't really fond of masked men.
Oh.
However, over the course of the St. Louis promotion, you can look at it and you see many wrestlers that did appear there under a mask. But they were never given the long-term push that other territories would give an individual under a mask.
Yeah.
And Sam would have them for a couple, 3-4 months maybe. And then it would come time that either the wrestler was going to be unmasked or he was going to just be gone.
Yeah.
He had the strange quirk I was talking about is that he had a few times when he would build a masked man up for the short term to get a title shot with the world champion. Well, here's where the quirk comes in. In the AWA, for instance, if in 1962, when Mr. M, masked, beat Vern Gagne, who was the champion at the time of the AWA, Mr. M was the champion with a mask. We still don't know who this dude is, according to the book. Okay, we got this guy with a mask holding the title. Well, Sam's quirk is that if you're a masked man and you're going to get a title shot, win or lose that night, your mask is coming off. So if you become the champion, which no masked man ever did become the champion, I mean, obviously that's behind the scenes. It wasn't going to happen.
Right.
But to the fans, if the masked man won the title, he had to reveal his identity. Because the NWA champion had to be known, and that was his quirk. So there was an instance in 1967 with a few months that went by. They had a masked wrestler named under a mask named Dr. Scarlet. Dr. Scarlet had a lavender purplish mask on, wore a purplish type cape, and he had a tunic, I believe was also kind of lavender. Nobody knew who Dr. Scarlet was, but he was a big dude. You know, appeared to be 250, 60, 70 pounds and over 6 foot. And he works his way up, you know, beating a couple of the top contenders in St. Louis and gets his title match with Gene Kaniski, who was the champ at the time. And, of course, that night, Dr. Scarlet is revealed. And it turned out to be Cowboy Bill Watts.
Oh. Wow.
So from there on, Bill Watts wrestled a few more cards in St. Louis as Bill Watts.
Yeah.
But he was there as Dr. Scarlet.
Yeah.
And the only irony that's cool about that, and nobody would have known this at the time because the territories, we didn't know what went on next door.
Right.
But during this time that he was working St. Louis, which is the only place that Dr. Scarlet wrestled, in St. Louis, that's the only place he wore this mask. At the same time, he was working full-time for Vern Gagne in the AWA as Bill Watts. So he'd fly into St. Louis on a Saturday night, wrestle his match, come back home.
Wow.
So it was kind of fun. And Sam did that with other masked wrestlers, too. Dr. Bill Miller, again, who was Mr. M back in the AWA days,
yeah,
he became the Crimson Knight in St. Louis.
Wow.
And he worked his way up to a title match, and he was revealed as Big Bill Miller.
Wow. Interesting.
So that was one of those little quirks. Sam did not want any gimmicks for the champion.
Yeah. Did you ever meet Sam in person?
I met Sam in 1971, but I could never tell you that we knew each other.
Okay.
I met him. I was in St. Louis that particular time for the Wrestling Fans International Association, WFIA, fan convention. And it was hosted that year in St. Louis. So okay. Sam had been the promoter that coordinated with the WFIA for their card and everything that night.
Okay.
I had met him, but it was a casual, you know, nice to meet you, Sam, and that sort of thing. But he didn't know me from the guy next door.
Okay.
I did have a good chance, though, at that same time to meet a guy by the name of Larry Mattisick. And Larry Mattisick, who was Sam's right-hand man, if you look at St. Louis history, Larry groomed himself and learned all his craft from Sam and went on to do some promoting himself. He was also the longtime announcer for St. Louis.
Oh, okay.
After when I was there in 71, the wrestling announcers was a guy named George Abel. Mm-hmm. And I don't know a lot about George Abel, but the other guy that was the announcer with him was Mickey Gargiola. And if you're a baseball fan, you obviously know the name Joe Gargiola.
Yeah.
And Mickey was George's brother.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, very probably friends with Sam Wichnick. Those were the two announcers, but Larry Mattisick was there, and Larry and I became friends. Larry was another guy that he's passed away, sadly, now, a year or so back, after suffering for more years than he should have. But just a sweetheart of a guy. And he went on after Sam got out of the promotion business and the St. Louis Wrestling Club was being promoted by, now owned at that point, by Vern Gagne, Bob Geigel, Harley Race, Pat O'Connor, the four guys that sort of combined their money and bought it up. Larry Mattisick for a while went out on his own. Again, one of those promotional wars, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And he was running against Vern was more of a silent partner in the whole situation. Mm-hmm. Geigel, O'Connor, and Race were from Central States who owned that territory, and they just took over St. Louis. But Larry started promoting on his own, created his own wrestling organization, and got some TV time in a channel there. I think he ran four or five cards. And again, they were cards that were loaded with talent. Yeah. And this was in the 80s, 83, 84-ish range.
Yeah.
And he had his own world champion. He gave legitimacy to his champion in St. Louis, for those who care. There was a tournament match down in Texas between Adrian Adonis and Tully Blanchard.
Ah.
And the winner of the referee of the match was Lou Thesz. And the winner of the match would be crowned Larry Mattisick's promotion's world champion and presented with the Lou Thesz belt, the original Alliance belt.
Yeah.
That was the championship belt. So wow. Adrian Adonis, believe it or not, before he went in the goofy gimmick with the
adorable.
With the East Coast Circus, because there was a talent.
Yeah.
In his Adonis days before he became adorable.
Yeah.
He was a heck of a worker.
Yeah.
And he got the Lou Thesz belt for that short
wow.
time.
That is amazing.
When Sam left the promotion, you know, like you had mentioned earlier, Brian, there were other NWA presidents. Fritz Von Erich was the president for a time,
mm-hmm.
Under his real name of Jack Adkison, has on record as the Alliance president. Bob Geigel was the Alliance president for a while. And Sam, though, after the other guys took over and Sam stepped down in 82, St. Louis was never the same again. And then we're just a year or so out, and the invasion starts and the whole business is changing, and
yeah.
You know, the rest is history. Yeah. So St. Louis, when Sam had his last card in St. Louis, there were literally a who's who of wrestlers of his generation that were still with us at the time.
Yeah.
That were on hand to celebrate with him on that card. And it was truly an end of an era when St. Louis was gone. And then McMahon came in, and he was running after Matisic didn't succeed, unfortunately. McMahon was in there and doing the same thing that he was doing in the other territories. He bought up the TV time. He bought up the arenas so that they couldn't promote. And, you know, by that time, Harley Race had moved over to the WWF.
Yeah.
And, it was St. Louis wrestling, but it was under the WWF. Flag at that time.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about that sometime as well, the expansion, and we can get into all that on another program. But I want to tell you, we're going to probably have to wrap her up. I really appreciate you coming on today and talking about St. Louis. It's been a pleasure. I've grown to, you know, really respect you. It's funny. I feel like I know you, but we've never met in person.
Well, we will.
We will.
We will. We will someday.
We will someday.
Where do you live? Where do you live? You're in?
I'm here.
You tell me all the time. You're in Missouri.
Missouri, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But my parents live in Wisconsin, but we will.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So sometime when you're visiting your parents, we're going to have to somehow.
Yeah, we will.
I'm not doing any traveling to Missouri in the future.
Don't blame you. All right. Well, Mr. George Shire, sir, thank you for coming out or coming on today. I really appreciate it. And I want to give one shout out real quick to Mr. Matt Walsh, who contributed to the podcast on our Anchor FM. If you'd like to do that, please go to Anchor FM and look for Brian Ferguson, and you can do that. George, sir, thank you very much. I want to do
my
this
pleasure.
Again.
I want to my do honor. Again thank you, Brian. You always do a great job. Thank you.
Thank you. And everybody, enjoy the podcast. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, this is a Total Package, Lex Luger, and you're listening to the VOC Nation. Don't miss out.
Hey, guys, before we get started, I just wanted to read this commercial because it's an agreement that we made with a really great podcast, and I want to tell you guys all about it. Pro Wrestling Interviews, it features guests who are hot indie stars as well as the greats of the ring. Each week, you can join the Amazing Velvet as well as Dr. John as they host this jam-packed hour of interviews, pro wrestling news, and entertaining guests. It's an hour you don't want to miss. Trust me, you don't want to miss it. Every Sunday, 9 p.m. Eastern, just go to ProWrestlingInterviews.com, and it'll take you to their Facebook page where you can get the custom podcast link for that week. Don't miss a second of Pro Wrestling Interviews. That's Sunday nights, 9 Eastern, ProWrestlingInterviews.com.
The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Check out In the Room.
Every Tuesday night at 9. Listen in.
Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Brady Hicks, former WCW star Stro Maestro, Cassie Fist, Matt Grimm.
And you and Ray are there too, right, Ray?
We sure are. And we've got great guests like Lex Luger, AJ Styles, Taku, and more. It's a heck of a party. Plus,
I didn't get thrown off buildings.
And then
I didn't get pregnant either.
Sometimes I think it gets so ridiculous.
We were getting into, like, snuff film territory there.
In the Room.
9 p.m. Eastern on VOC Nation.
Yo, this is Jerry Stiles of the Nasty Boys. Yeah, Brian Knobbs here. You getting ready to get nasty? Well, listen to the VOC Nation, baby.
VOC Nation is one of the longest-running wrestling podcast networks. Having started way back in 2010, VOC Nation provides daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with their hosts and guests via phone calls, emails, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts include former backstage interviewer from both AWA and WWE, Ken Resnick, former WCW performer The Maestro, former Impact performer Wes Crisco, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributor Brady Hicks, and former Philadelphia radio personality Bruce Works. Archive-free content includes past interviews with huge names like Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, Kurt Angle, Jimmy Hart, Ricky Steamboat, Sting, Mick Foley, Joey Styles, Howard Finkel, and so many more. Listen live at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all the podcasts by searching VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. And be sure to follow these guys on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Phil Apter has been in the pro wrestling business for over 50 years.
Hey, talking here with Arn Anderson. Arn, first of all, your height and weight.
6'1", 255.
And now subscribers to VOC Nation Premium get exclusive access to Bill Apter's archived audio footage.
And where's your hometown?
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, and give us something about your back. First of all, your relationship to Ole Anderson.
Ole is my...
Subscription to VOC Nation Premium starts at just $3 a month and includes commercial-free audio and video versions of our top podcasts.
Okay, we're speaking here with the manager of the World Heavyweight Tag Team Champions, Tarzan Tyler and Luke Graham, and he's sort of glowing tonight about a new prospect we haven't heard of yet.
And for just $9 a month, Apter's archives are all yours.
Would you tell us who this new prospect
is? Well,
I'll
tell you, Bill, I've searched the world, and I finally found a true world champion. I finally found...
What's your opinion of Ivan Koloff winning the title from Bruno Sammartino?
Well, I think... I don't know what to say, but I want to say one thing. Bruno was an elevated champion. You know?
Hear exclusive interviews with the greatest performers of all time.
This is Bill Apter, and once again, we're speaking here with Bruno Sammartino. Bruno, first of all, how did you and Bruiser lose that title to the Valiants?
Well, actually, it was a very unusual loss, if you want to call it a loss.
Did it have anything to do?
Well, yes, but the whole thing is this, that the rules, as I always understood them, was that the title could only be lost by pin or submission, which is the same rules as my title, the World Wrestling Federation. That night, it was...
To sign up, it's very simple. Head to premium.vocnation.com or go to patreon.com/vocnation. VOC Nation takes you behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history.
Each and every Thursday night, check it out. WCW star Stro Maestro takes you on a journey. It's WCW Retro. Talking old school match of the week, talking dream matches, taking your calls and looking back on an incredible career of acting, entertaining, and wrestling. Check it out, VOCNation.com, WCW Retro. Be sure to call in Thursday nights, 9 Eastern, on the VOC Nation Radio Network.
This is Matt Hardy, and you are listening to the VOC Nation.